everybody. This is Alyssa Klein. You're tuning into episode 4 of Filminist Pod. This episode is presented by Listening Party and recorded inside of Canal Street Radio. Ba-da-da. Ba-da-da.
Ba-da-da. You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with
other. Hi, Raquel. Would you mind just introducing yourself?
Sure. My name is Raquel Gates. I am an associate professor of cinema and media studies at the College of Staten Island.
Awesome. And would you mind just sharing a little about your own story and how you came to be involved in media studies?
Sure. So it's a little bit of a winding road to media studies. There's some people who were film or, you know, media studies majors in undergrad, and that wasn't me. I went to Georgetown. I was in the School of Foreign Service thinking that I was going to be a diplomat or, I don't know, president at some point. And I think in my sophomore year, that was sort of the moment that I realized that I wasn't really into politics, but I was really interested in culture. And so I started taking classes in popular culture and some television and media studies type of things and film studies. And at that point, I still wasn't sure if I was going to do like anthropology or a master's degree or something related to another aspect of popular culture. And I went ahead and did a master's degree in general humanities at the University of Chicago. And that was the point where I decided that I really wanted to concentrate in film and media. And so that's what I went to Northwestern to do my PhD in.
What was your concentration in?
So my concentration was in racial representation in popular culture.
And so pardon my ignorance here. So I'm just a total, novice when it comes to what exactly someone who works in media studies does. Would you mind just for lay people like myself explaining what your life is like as someone involved in media studies?
Sure. So mainly I'm a professor who researches and teaches in the areas of film and media studies. So for example, right now I'm trying to get my syllabi together for my classes. I'm teaching one introduction to film class where students who've probably never thought critically about film before are going to learn how lighting and editing and narrative works in film and helps to create meaning and messages. And I'm also teaching a course in reality television, which I'm super excited about because it's a critical sort of history of the genre.
You wrote your dissertation. It was called Acting White. Could you just tell us a little about it?
Sure. So my dissertation was about whiteface, so black mm-hmm. performers in whiteface in film and television. And that was inspired by sitting in my cousin's apartment one time, and she was watching White Chicks with the Wayans brothers, and I had never seen it before. And I remember sort of sitting there and watching it and thinking, this is pretty amazing to be this sort of, you know, sort of silly comedy that's really interrogating issues of whiteness and white privilege and the ways that white femininity is complicit in power structures. And the fact that nobody seemed to have been writing about this or thinking critically about it, I thought was sort of a crime.
And when did you write that?
I started my PhD in 2004, 2005, and finished in 2010. It was working on it. I mean, I didn't really start my dissertation until towards the end of my grad school career. Before that, I thought maybe I'd write about like women in hip hop films or, you know, I don't know. I wasn't entirely sure. But I probably started working on the whiteface stuff in earnest in about 2007, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. And it would, if you were to write a second part to your dissertation, do you have any sort of like takeaways on if at all anything has changed in culture and society since then?
Well, one of the things that I think is really interesting about the sort of contemporary moment of film and media is that you have such a proliferation of black content and black content creators. And in some ways, the discourse around that, you know, I'm thinking about the ways that a lot of film critics are talking about Jordan Peele or Ava DuVernay, who are, you know, fantastic filmmakers, obviously. But there's an interesting way in which, because they have receive such mainstream attention and mainstream presence, they're being discussed as if everything they're doing is brand new. And so one of the projects that I'm working on now, which is sort of, you know, feels like a bit of a sequel to some of the stuff I did in my dissertation, is really sort of tracing back this legacy of Black pop culture that uses whiteface and uses sort of surrealism and uses irreverent comedy to bring attention to power structures, which are the things that people are discussing right now.
So is there anything recently that's been on your mind?
I mean, I think Netflix itself has been on my mind, in terms of the amount of diverse programming that's happening there and is going there, and the ways that people are talking about Netflix as this sort of new horizon for film and media production and distribution. I think it provides a really good opportunity to sort of maybe reflect back on some industry history and think about the moments in the past when there's been similar excitement over, you know, some new structure that was going to, quote, change Hollywood. And of course, that rarely happens. So I find the stuff with Netflix really interesting. As someone who's obsessed with reality TV and is published a lot on reality television, to see that genre continue to evolve and develop and now sort of bleed over into what would be considered like conventional media and conventional celebrity, that's a really fascinating moment for me. BravoCon is happening in November, which is...
Are you going to it?
I am not. I'm going to tell you why. Unless they invite me to be on a panel or something, I can't afford to go to that thing. Because I was really excited when I heard about BravoCon. Partly as a fan, partly as a researcher.
One question. What is BravoCon?
Oh, sure. So BravoCon is, it's essentially like Comic-Con. It is a gathering of fans of Bravo's reality television offerings that Andy Cohen is putting together in New York City. So there's going to be panels and lunches and meet and greets with the cast members of like all the Real Housewives shows and Southern Charm and Top Chef. So, it's kind of like the big moment for reality TV fans. But BravoCon tickets are kind of insanely expensive. I think a day pass is $125, and that's just a day pass. And I think upwards of maybe $1,500 for a 3-day VIP experience. So, I don't think I'm going to be attending.
which is just another reminder about the fact that in the conversation right now, we're often hearing about diversity and inclusiveness, mm-hmm. but often when people are talking about diversity and inclusiveness, they're not accounting for things beyond what we're seeing on screen. Mm-hmm. But you really need to, if you're going to host these events and you actually are committed to inclusiveness, which I don't know that they've said that, but you need to account for the fact that these events aren't accessible.
Right. I mean, I would even sort of pivot in relation to what you just said. We talk about diversity and inclusiveness in terms of representation. That's always the way the conversation goes. If we're talking about women, if we're talking about minorities, there's this habit of counting, right? Like, how many women were in the film? How many lines did the woman in the film get? And in some ways, I think that work is important, but I also think from a media studies perspective, it just sort of misses the mark, because then we're always doing very surface representation as a sign of progress. And so BravoCon becomes really interesting. I mean, all of reality television is fascinating from a standpoint of labor, which is one of the things I talk about in my book, Double Negative. I have a whole chapter that's just about the labor of women on reality television. And, reality television starts from a writer's strike. It literally has its origins in issues of labor, right? Studios and production companies trying to find ways around paying for unionized labor. And so that's where reality television comes from, because, you know, at least at its start, it's not the same anymore. You didn't have to pay people like you would, you know, paid actors, right? You could give them maybe a per diem, but it was just really sort of like a cheap form of labor. And so when you get to the point where something like BravoCon is attracting, I mean, I'm on a message board, a Facebook group for like Bravo TV fans, and like people are flying in for this. People are like, you know, I live in California, but I'm buying my plane tickets to come to BravoCon, and I paid $1,500 for the VIP pass, and I'm getting a hotel. I'm doing it up, right? And then you think about how much the cast members of these shows are being paid. or how much the producers or the writers, but we can't call them writers, right? Because that would sort of break the conceit of reality television. And the ways that I think particularly the cast members who are the draw, you know, they're the draw. It's like Disney World, right? You go to see the princesses. What are they making in relation to what these networks are sort of making in profits off of their labor? And their labor is them performing on the show and opening up their lives and, you know, putting all of their sort of personal, you know, drama out there for our consumption. So it's a thing I've been, you know, thinking through in past work and ongoing work.
You mentioned your book. Could you tell us more about it?
Sure. So the title of my book is Double Negative, The Black Image and Popular Culture. And the book is, it's a sort of a theoretical treatise on trashy black pop culture. And the title sort of comes from this idea that a lot of times in popular discourse, when people talk about racial representation, they'll say, is this a positive or a negative representation? And in film and media studies, there's been a very big push to try to get away from that language because it's reductive and it's sort of overly simplistic. And what I argue in the book is that in some ways, we may never get away from that language, but maybe there's actually something really politically progressive and subversive about these so-called negative images. So I make a hard case for advocating for the power of a TV show like Flavor of Love or like other reality TV shows that have been deemed, you know, sort of problematic. And I also talk about Coming to America, the Eddie Murphy, John Landis film from the 80s and some not terribly great 90s comedies. And I also have a chapter in there on Halle Berry and sort of how her, you know, celebrity star changes over time.
Do you have any thoughts on the Coming to America sequel?
I am excited to see it. I don't have a lot of faith that it's going to be good. It's exciting that, you know, it seems like the entire original cast is back. Some of the things I'm reading about the screenplay, you know, they raise some red flags for me because it seems like the premise sort of directly contradicts sort of what made the original, like, fun and you know, heartwarming and all of that. So I don't know. I think the time to make that film was in the late 80s, and I think this is a weird time to be revisiting it, even though it feels like it's part of the industry pattern of reboots, right, which are happening all over. I don't know how many reboots have been successful, critically or commercially. I hope that the new Coming to America film will break that trend. I don't have confidence that it will.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, off the top of my head, I can't even think of a reboot that I would want to watch again.
Yeah.
And do you think it'll touch on immigration in a meaningful way at all?
I mean, no. And I think if it did, it would actually sort of break the agreement, the tacit agreement between the film and the audience. I mean, if you look at the original Coming to America, which I write about in the book, I adore the film. The film is not without its problems, obviously, but I adore it. But Zamunda is a fantasy world, right? You know, I've joked with people that if we were to really sort of interrogate, you know, Akeem's family, they would likely be like military dictators, right? I mean, how else do we sort of account for this extreme wealth in this country that, you know, contemporary politics tells us like how that happens, and the political processes by which you would get a country like Zamunda. But of course you don't touch on that in that film. It doesn't touch on any kind of, you know, significant politics. I don't say that to mean I think that the original is like a colorblind film or it's not interested in identity, but I think it's very much interested in cultural identity. But in terms of, you know, like politics, like what's happening in the government and things like that, that's not present in the original, and that's not what I think people are signing on for if they go see the sequel.
Yeah. And I want to go back to something that you touched on earlier. You were talking about the labor history of reality TV. Mm-hmm. That's a concept that is totally new to me, and I'm fascinated and I'm going to read your book. I want to learn more. So I vaguely recall maybe it was the 90s or early 2000s that there was a writer's strike. Mm-hmm. Is that the same writer's strike that reality TV formed out of?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And just for all of us who aren't too familiar with the history, could you just, for a moment, just some background on that writer's strike?
Sure. So you have a Writers Guild strike that happens in, you know, like the early to mid 2000s, and you have the situation now where networks and production companies they don't have content because they have no one to sort of produce content for them. And so reality television becomes the solution because you can hire all of this non-union labor. You don't have to pay writers because, you know, officially on reality television there are no writers, right? You have if you look at the credits for reality TV shows, you won't ever see a writer listed, but you'll see a million producers listed. And again, the conceit of reality television is we're just filming real people doing real things, and there's no storylines, and we don't direct them, and it's just them being them, and we happen to capture it and then edit the footage. So reality TV also, I mean, consider that with reality television, at least sort of the boom of the mid-2000s, you don't have to pay actors, right? They don't have SAG cards. These are just regular people who maybe you give them, again, you know, some money per day if they're doing like a candid reality show. But, you know, this is really just a cheap form of labor. What you see, I've been contacting some people in the industry to come in as guest speakers from a reality television class, and looking at their resumes, I mean, people with MFAs from NYU who can't find jobs, or, you know, reality television becomes a really big site of employment for incredibly talented people working in the film industry. But of course, because it at least historically wasn't regulated in the way that scripted programming would be, you can get people for basically nothing.
Is there a union?
That's a good question. I'm not sure at this point. I know that a lot of the talent, they're sort of pursuing contract negotiations the same way that like actors on sitcoms would, and mm-hmm. things like that, because, you know, they've gotten quite savvy, as they should. But yeah, I'm not aware that there is, but there very well might be.
I was recently reading that, or from a friend who's a filmmaker, I saw that music video directors are one of the few directors that don't have a union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not surprising. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot with a new project that I'm working on is, you know, again, coming back to representation issues of diversity, one of the things we don't talk about are the ways that certain forms, certain structures maintain inequity, right? So if in some ways film production is like an old boys club, right? And you're on the crew of this film, and therefore, you know, you get brought onto the next film set, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What happens when you are a person of color, when you're a woman who, you know, doesn't want to sort of put up with the casual sexism or racism on the set, right? You don't really get brought on to the next thing. And so what you see very often are women and minorities working in these, quote, lesser genres. I don't consider them to be lesser genres, right? But you see them going into these more unregulated spaces like music video, like reality television. And, you know, one of the ways that you know, sort of power replicates itself is we don't talk about those sites of production as being art, right? We talk about the big blockbuster Hollywood films, or maybe the, you know, the really sort of notable independent film directors, never sort of realizing that even our decision to focus on those sites is itself a form of replicating inequality.
Would you say that the way you watch TV is informed at all by your work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, first and foremost, I always tell people that I'm a fan. I would never refer to myself. You hear some people say, like, I'm a film buff. I'd never call myself a film buff. I call myself a fan of film and a fan of television. And one of the things that I always try to impress upon my students is that having like an academic background or just sort of a working academic knowledge of how film and television gets made and some of these larger issues, whether they're like ideological or aesthetic or theoretical issues, that to me only enriches the experience. To be honest, I've rarely reached a conclusion about a film or television show that a friend or a family member who does not have my academic background hasn't also reached. They just don't necessarily have the language or the tools to theorize it in the way that I do. And that's what I see my intervention as a scholar as being.
Awesome. I love that. Are there any shows that you're currently watching?
Oh, sure. Everything that's on Bravo and VH1, that's basically where my television is 24/7. So Real Housewives of Potomac, Real Housewives of Orange County just started again. And there's a interesting sort of storyline with one of the main cast members' sons, who's a very big Trump supporter, and is also has some weird histories with, like, misogyny and other things. And so it's a little uncomfortable, but also really sort of interesting to watch in this this moment. Vanderpump Rules will be starting again soon, which I completely obsessively adore. VH1, I'm a very big fan of Love and Hip Hop. And Mona Scott Young, who's the executive producer, who I'm completely obsessed with. You have this, you know, this black woman who has done this sort of amazing programming in reality television, who, again, is someone I don't understand why we're not talking about her in the ways that we should be. The storylines that she brings up, the number of queer characters of color.
What show is she on?
So Mona Scott Young is the executive producer, the showrunner for basically all of the Love and Hip Hops on VH1. Love and Hip Hop, the original, which is in New York. Love and Hip Hop, Atlanta. Love and Hip Hop, Hollywood. Love and Hip Hop, Miami. And I mention that because those are shows that have been raising and really thoroughly delving into issues of race and gender and sexual identity for a very long time. And so before we started recording, you and I were chatting about Pose. And one of the things I've sort of, you know, casually ranted about is that, you know, give Pose all the credit it should be receiving. Absolutely. But, you know, Love and Hip Hop, Mona Scott Young was introducing black, queer, and trans characters years before Ryan Murphy debuted Pose. And again, has sort of never received any attention for doing so. And not characters who were introduced in the ways that I think a lot of television sort of, you know, like the very special episode, like we're going to have a queer character on, you know, for one episode and then they're going to disappear. The characters who were completely woven into the storyline, who were main cast members, whose storylines didn't shy away from their identity, but were also not completely all about their identity. I always thought that was incredibly powerful and impactful.
Let's say someone's listening or read, we have transcripts of each episode, just checking out the show, and they're thinking, wow, your work sounds amazing. What would be sort of the first step for them to begin a career in media studies?
So if they wanted to be a professor in media studies, you know, which is what I do. I mean, I think the first step would be, if you are in college, to take some film and media studies classes and go visit your professors during office hours and talk to them about what you're interested in. You know, not everybody is going to go on to do a PhD in anything, right? Because PhDs take a long time and require a lot of, you know, personal and financial investment. But I think taking these classes and sort of studying these things and having a really good working knowledge is something that can translate into other industries, whether you become a journalist, whether you have, you know, you're a cultural critic doing this type of writing, whether you're working at, let's say, a network and, you know, being in the person in the room who talks about casting and storylines and things of that nature. All of that seems incredibly, you know, valuable and important.
What does the rest of your year look like?
The rest of my year, well, the academic year is just getting started. So for the rest of the summer, I will be trying to wrap up some research projects and writing, you know, that I've been working on all summer, spending quality time with my kids. I have twin boys who are 3.5. We're starting pre-K in about 2 or 3 weeks. So I have to get them ready for that. And then getting ready for the start of the semester. That's the summer. And then once the school year starts, it's teaching, trying to squeeze in some writing. I have a number of book talks that are sort of scheduled, and, you know, other academic talks. So I, you know, kind of travel around the country to different schools and institutions. That's what the year is.
And if someone wants to find your book, how could they find it?
Sure. So you can find my book on the Duke University Press website. It's also available on Amazon. You can also go to my website, which is RaquelGates.com, and there is a link to purchase the book, as well as upcoming event dates and things like that. I'm still working on the website, so not everything's up yet, but that's the easiest place to find like anything having to do with my work or stuff that I'm involved in.
Do you think that the larger sort of like film and TV ecosystem could do a better job of working with media scholars? And if so, kind of like what could that role look like?
Sure. Yes. You know, quick answer. Yes, absolutely. You know, in my dream scenario, people in the industry, producers, writers, et cetera, would bring on film and media studies scholars as consultants. They bring us in and talk about script ideas, and we could steer them sort of clear of tropes and cliches, or maybe suggest some ideas for how things might be done better or in more interesting ways or more nuanced ways. You know, we as film and media scholars, we devote our entire careers to studying the history, the theories, the aesthetics of film and media studies. And there's always something very frustrating about seeing, you know, the industry sort of have amnesia about things that have happened 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I would love to see more collaboration between the scholarly film and media studies communities and the industry.
Is there anything else that's been on your mind?
You know, I said before we started recording that I'm in deep sort of like teaching prep mode. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is the space of the classroom. I mean, we talk a lot in, you know, film and media studies about what we screen and thinking about the industry. But also, I think as a teacher, thinking about the type of inclusive space that we create in our classrooms, in terms of discussing films, in terms of introducing films and television shows to students, that also feels like, you know, pretty important work to be engaged in.
Thanks everyone for listening to episode 4 of Filminist Pod. Special thank you to our guest, Raquel Gates. This episode was presented in partnership with Listening Party. Be sure to follow the Listening Party crew on Instagram at Listening Party Presents, and also follow Canal Street Market on Instagram at Canal Street Market.
Just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys. And don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. And please, when I go out with you, don't put me on display. You don't know me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay. And don't tell me what to do. And don't tell me what to say.